Hi, this is Marlena Lieber welcoming you to Blind Spot. Blind Spot is a series of programs heard this time each week on ACB Radio where we talk no-tech, low-tech kinds of things. If you've got an idea for something you'd like to hear on Blind Spot, why not drop me an email? My email address is Marlena, that's M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org. Hello, and welcome to Blind Spot. This is Marlena Lieberg speaking. We are going to spend some time with someone whom I have come to know from some of the listservs that I've been on, but not until Blind Spot did I really have a good reason to call her up and hear her voice, even though I often wanted to, because she sounded like such a cool person. Deborah DeVord, welcome to Blind Spot.
Thank you, my friend. I hope I can live up to all that.
Well, you know, when I first called you, I thought, well, let's talk about the Braille cookbooks that Deborah has written, and let's talk about cooking and recipes, because that was the venue in which I came to know you. And then, in our conversation, not only did I learn that Deborah is a writer and a teacher, but that Deborah is bilingual, that Deborah is a dancer, that Deborah is a weaver. How the heck did you get interested in all these things?
Well, sure, Marlena. I guess we have to go back in the dark ages, back to the 50s, watching my mother. And I noticed that it really wasn't the food or the preparation that my mother was interested in. It was the service or the serving people and having lots of friends over. And I don't want to say entertaining, because so many people are afraid to entertain these days. I find that kind of regrettable, because it is so easy and it's so much fun.
It is.
And I noticed that our house was always full of people. And with myself being in high school, my little sister in junior high, and my little brother in elementary school, it was just all ages, all times, night and day, and she was always in the kitchen. And so I noticed that it was the food, of course, was the attraction for the kids, but it was also the hospitality and the kind of open generosity. In fact, one of my favorite lines from my mother is, she's a Texan, you have to know, I suppose if I'd be invited to the White House, I'd be supposed to bring a dish. And so a lot of things that we did growing up revolved around taking a dish somewhere, whether it was a funeral or a church dinner on the ground, all kinds of things like that. So I got involved with food very early, not for food itself, but for what it meant.
The sort of camaraderie and fellowship of it.
Yes, and yeah. Eventually I'm a really lucky girl. I've gotten to travel quite a bit, and even as early as third grade, I knew there was a lot of stuff out there I wanted to see and do. And took some little Spanish classes before school, et cetera. And I made sure that when I finished my degrees that I was going to be able to use those degrees and my teaching experience and stuff in order to get to other countries. And so I've been a lucky kid. As I said, I've gotten to teach in China and Bulgaria and Yugoslavia and Guatemala, lots of different places. And I also have gotten to travel to a lot of places, not to work but just to visit. And I sort of mentally collect. I never made a point to write anything down, much of anything, but I sort of mentally collected what it was that people did, which revolved around food, because that seems to be the social focal point of many different cultures, and so that if you can't meet in any other way, you'll meet over coffee, or if you're not allowed either by government choice or your choice, not allowed to do certain things, there are always ways to do it as long as food is involved. So I found that kind of interesting. And so throughout the years, I've gotten to see a lot from not just different cultures, but different areas here in the United States. I mean, things as different as, you know, Texas barbecues and Cajun cooking in Louisiana, all the way up the coast to New York. I mean, lots of things here in the States even are quite wildly different from one place to the other. One of the ways I got interested in actually writing was I thought I would like to take up some French preparation, which is, you know, very involved and can be simple, but a lot of times you end up spending hours and hours. I thought, well, I'd like to at least try it. And again, I was a lucky girl. I got invited to cook with Jacques Pepin, who is a famous French presidential chef. He cooked for Charles de Gaulle and Mitterrand and different, three or four different presidents. And he now has a PBS show here in the States.
Yes.
Several shows, actually. I think he's currently doing Cooking with Claudine, his daughter. But I got invited to cook with him up in Aspen at Jill St. John's house of all. I mean, it was just a wild story how I got there.
You have been around, my dear.
Well, anyway, I got to cook with him, and I've been cooking in the dark for years, and so I do things, you know, that are just second nature to me and seem very natural. And he was just amazed at some of the techniques. And I said, now look, I said, it's nothing that not anybody could figure out. It's no magic. It's no big thing. I'm not a blind cook. I'm a cook that just happens to be blind, and I just have to find other ways to do it.
One of the things I try to encourage people that I'm working with to do very liberally and frequently is be very safe about it, but stick your hands down into that pan.
Oh, I don't even use a spoon to stir anymore. And I always like to try first to find the low-tech, guys, if anyone doesn't have common sense, that would be me, but kind of the common sense approach, the low-tech thing. So there's lots of ways you can address all of these things. I know that when I was trying to write in the cookbook, back to Jacques Pepin was actually the person who said, you need to write these things down. And I said, yeah, but who's going to want it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and plus, it takes a lot of words to describe how it is you separate an egg, for example. And he said, somebody needs to record this. And he's also a cookbook author, or he's actually a techniques author himself. And he said, this needs to be recorded and made available to the public. So when I'm writing these things, when I was starting to collect all these and record them all, I was thinking, okay, separate an egg, for example. Well, there are all kinds of ways you can do it. And then it was, you know, a friend that said, and don't forget, you can just do it in your bare hand. And I was thinking, oh, my gosh, I haven't done that since I was a kid.
Sometimes the simplest way for cooking, well, in many things, but certainly for cooking, sometimes the simplest way is the easiest way. And I really am, I have a friend who usually listens to my program, and she's a young lady. She's just kind of getting into the age where she's learning to cook, and she will email me frequently. She lives in Minnesota. Hello, Nikki. And she will. I'm sort of her older blind big sister, if you will. And she'll email me and she'll say, "I want to make a toasted cheese sandwich." And I tell her, you know, get that bread in the pan, and then feel for it with that spatula, and then put your finger down there and make sure you've got it turned over. You know.
Excellent.
Now, let me ask you: do you have as a cook who is blind? Do you have a preference for gas or electric cooking?
Well, I would probably kill for a gas stove.
Really? I'm just the opposite. Isn't that funny?
And I don't, I want to say that a lot of times people love what they start with, but I discovered a gas stove living in an older home one time. But I do not enjoy cooking in a gas oven. So I guess my dream kitchen would have a gas stove and an electric oven.
Sure, you could have a wall oven that's electric and a gas countertop stove. That's funny.
The instant control that you get with gas.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at any rate, I just like to be familiar with what I'm using, so that I know that my right front burner is a dog, and I'm not going to use that to do one type of preparation on. I might use it to boil water, but my rear left one, for example, is really good for so-and-so. And you just find that out through experience.
Right.
And so, actually, I guess the answer is that I don't care if I'm cooking on an open fire, which I've done trail cooking before. And when our electricity goes out here, we have to use a wood stove, being high in mountains.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happens often. So I don't mind. I don't really care what it is, as long as I'm familiar with it and know how it's going to act. The cookbooks, as I said, started with under someone else's suggestion, and it took me, oh gosh, I was still teaching full time at the time, so it took me a couple of years to gather recipes and to actually write the techniques. And what I did was to ask, I believe we have, oh, a dozen or maybe 15 or so, it's been so long I can't remember, famous authors such as Molly Katzen of Moosewood and Jacques Pepin himself all kinds of the Greens Cookbook and Deborah Madison and so people that are actually on my shelves as a dedicated cook. And so we got them to donate recipes, and then I also included my own favorites, as not because I was too lazy to write my own, because I certainly could have, but to show people that they can pull any recipe out of anywhere, out of any cookbook or any family recipe, and adapt it to their own technique, and just how to use a recipe as a springboard. And so what we did was to collect all those recipes, and then from those recipes, I just kind of started one into the kitchen of the other, sort of at the market, actually, I believe is where it starts, at the supermarket, how to, you know, some easy ways to make your shopping a little bit easier and some ways to get shopping services, et cetera, kind of into the kitchen, you know, how to make maps in your mind of what is in the refrigerator and how to organize things so that you're not spending a lot of time in frustration getting things ready, and as well as all the preparations at the counter, on the stove, out the door, in the oven, out the door being like how to do barbecuing and picnics and things like that. And once we organized all that, and here was the hard part, I took each recipe. I might be cooking a potato or making a potato leek soup out of Moosewood Cookbook. What are all the preparations that go into that? And I cross-referenced each recipe so that if in that recipe, if you need to know how to wash your produce, then it refers you to page so-and-so.
Wow.
If you need to know how to cut an onion without tearing up over it, then you refer to page so-and-so. And each one of those recipes is cross-referenced only for the things that it needs. And so, and also only for the things that you need. If you know how the heck to wash produce, then you don't have to look that up. But maybe you've never, maybe you've cut yourself too often, you know, slicing a potato really thinly. So maybe you need to go to that section and read that. So we started with a large print just because it was a place to start. Not for any other good reason than that. We had to start somewhere. And so it was available on large print and on computer discs. And that met the needs of one part of the population, which is the large print readers and the computer users. And it was certainly time to think about another step, which was the Braille issue. So I contacted National Braille Press, and they have Brailled the entire cookbook. But they've done something kind of cool. They've separated it into two volumes so that if all you want is the recipes, if you're a dedicated cook and don't want any information on how to do certain techniques, then you can buy only the recipes. If you are a Braille reader or possibly you have a Braille client who needs just the techniques, then you can buy only those, or you can buy them as a set. And that's five volumes total. The large print is in one spiral-bound notebook so that you can fold it back, and mine has spills on every other page. And it's kind of in tacky condition right now, but it's a well-used book. And then eventually, my friend and technical support fellow here at the house decided, wouldn't it be cool to put it on CD? And so now it's just this, I mean, just like last week, has become available on CD.
Oh, so this is a scoop for blind spotters.
Yes,
all right.
And it's available on CD, which I find really cool, because if you are a computer user and like to print out only the things that you're interested in embracing,
exactly,
then you can print out only this recipe, but we're going to skip the one with goat in it because we don't eat goat
right
in this house. And we're still, you know, improving on that, because there's always something you can do better with the technology as new versions of different things come out. So we're improving that as we go along. And so that was one book and one step.
And what is the name of that book?
The name of that book is Cooking with Feeling and Other Useful Senses, a culinary guide of techniques for blind and visually impaired cooks. Long title. Cooking with Feeling is what most people call it. And it's now available in those formats. National Braille Press said that they were getting quite the clamor for, and I thought she was going to say crock pots. I mean, I had all kinds of things in mind. And she said bread machines.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, wow, okay, I have a bread machine. I do a lot of you know, about once a week I'll make, you know, some kind of weird bread or something. And so, yeah, I could do that. And she said, well, one of the problems is that for the blind cook, and I, of course, it's always one of our problems, is that the machinery itself is not accessible. It has membrane switches, which you have to be able to see a dot somewhere or a light lights up when it's about to do a certain thing. And what are some ways around that? So I wrote, and this is available from them also in Braille. It's called Loafer's Companion, and it's the Bread Machine Bread Lover's Cookbook. And it's available in Braille from them, and then I can also have that in large print and on computer disk. as well. So that was the second one. Then we thought, okay, who are we leaving out? Children. And I just got down and dirty with some really cool food with a bunch of kids, and we put together a really nice cookbook, which is actually at the editor's desk as we speak, and it's called High Five Kids in the Kitchen. And it's going to be in the dual format where you have large print over Braille, so that if your parents are the blind individuals and they can read along with the children, or if the children are the blind individuals and they can read while the parent's looking over, the sighted parent looking over his shoulder to see what kind of trouble they're going to get into next. And it turned out to be so fat and hefty, we decided to hack it into three books, starting with a younger age and kind of the easy, fun things that all kids like to do, s'mores and different kinds of things to torture hot dogs with, and fun stuff like that for the littler kids for whom you don't want to be dealing with sharp knives and certain things.
Sure.
And then we have an intermediate book that'll come out second, and then a more advanced book for the sleepover kids.
Boy, that is so cool.
Yeah, and that was a lot of fun to do, and I can't wait to see that come out, because that'll be fun.
Well, now tell me, do you have a Deborah DeBoard favorite quick recipe?
Oh, gosh, quick, let me think.
Among the bazillions you have in your head.
You know, I think we have, as a culture, we've kind of lost the drop-by visit, the kind of the drop-in guest. And we have them here at the house. In fact, I've got a sign up on the door right now, go away. I'm on the radio. But we've kind of lost that as a culture, sort of. And one of the things that encourages people to do that, I mean, other than your hospitality and saying, hey, if you show up and I'm in dirty shorts or whatever, you're going to have to take it, and as long as people know that. But one of the things that helps that along, I think, or kind of encourages that, is not to always have something elaborate planned for food or anything, but I like to always have just a few inexpensive things that can be put together just at the very last minute, so that when somebody drops by, you've got something, you have something to offer. And I was thinking of something like cream cheese, like blocks of cream cheese stay for a really long time in your refrigerator, and if you're not a cream cheese eater anyway, I mean, they'll stay for a couple of weeks, and we usually end up using them on bagels or something else anyway. But I always have, like, this extra block of cream cheese. And you can't even imagine the stuff you can do with that with a drop-in guest. And we always have a variety of crackers and breads and things, either from the bread machine or 1 6-month period I was obsessed with trying to figure out how to make real French baguettes. And we had tiles imported and all kinds of things. So there was always French bread going on. But even if that's not your interest and all you have is a box of Ritz in the cabinet, fine. And but crackers are some kind of bread, and then cream cheese covers very well, and it stands up very well. So if you just hack off a piece of that, or even if you use the soft stuff in a tub, you can kind of scoop some out on a plate, and then cover it with either, I usually have two sides to it, so that one side is hot and spicy. It could be anything like salsa out of a jar. It could be, I always have this stuff called pica pepa, which is a Jamaican brown sauce that you get, it's like close to the Worcestershire sauce or ketchup or something in your grocery store.
Making me hungry.
Yeah, or even just a simple barbecue sauce out of a bottle. You know, nobody knows.
Yeah, and you know what else is good on top of cream cheese, and I'm sure you've done this, but I found it out by accident, is chutney.
Yes, chutney.
Whoa.
And that's what I was going to say. On the other end, I put something a little sweeter.
Yeah.
Like chutney, or I've even opened up a can of blueberry or cherry pie filling, and just kind of slop that on the top, and it's pretty for your sighted visitors. It's beautiful, and underneath that is the cream cheese, and it looks real pretty on the plate, and it stands up well for a couple of hours, even in the summer. You know, even if you're out, you just put it out on the deck or whatever, and that and a few crackers, and you've got something very easy. That's also something easy. We live way up in the mountains, in the Rocky Mountains, way away from towns and all that, so when I go to a potluck, I have to find things that are easy that travel well, because a lot of times I have to maybe even combine it with a trip to town, and it's got to be in my backpack all day. I mean, no telling what's going on around here. So we have to have things that travel well and stay for a long time. So something like that I might even take, even though, you know, my friends all know that I'm a fairly good cook, and they expect something, you know, kind of elaborate from me sometimes, and maybe that's what I take that time. But it works great because it's pretty and it stands up well, and it's very easy and it stores well for a long period of time.
Have you done anything with the sugar art?
Well, this is very interesting because I don't even think it was a week ago, 2 weeks ago maybe, that the woman who's editing the children's cookbook passed on, you don't have anything about frosting or decorating a cake. And I thought, oh, holy cow, because it's something that I don't do. And I thought that I had covered every possible aspect of the kitchen, and then here comes cake decorating. So my only experience with cake decorations is getting the one off the top of my sister's wedding cake, accidentally putting it in the oven. I thought I was putting it somewhere else, and it actually caught on fire. So,
dear.
Well, anyway, so my answer is I don't do anything with cake decorating, but I know lots of people who do. And we have a very fine culinary school here in the area that gives 2 week classes in cake decoration. And I asked her about the accessibility of the class because some of the classes are, quite frankly, more accessible than others. And she said that is one that would be very good for the blind and visually impaired. Because it's a very tactile thing. Do you do it yourself?
Well, no, but it is a goal that I intend to meet.
If you'll look around Christmas time, there's usually not just cake decorating, but I don't even know what to call it, like construction or something where you're making, and it's not just gingerbread. I mean, it's lots of different kinds of houses and scenes and things which are edible. And so you do your art, and then it is something that will sit on your table, on your creche or your Christmas table or Hanukkah altars and things, and then you eventually eat them at the end of the season. So there's more than just even cake decorating out there.
And so the bottom line is that people should not assume that if they are blind or low vision, that this is a sighted thing. This is something anybody
and
can
I,
try.
You know, I feel that way about everything. When I did my first parachute jump, I mean, I had to, like, talk the people into it. I mean, this was back in the 70s, long before days of everybody suing everybody else anyway. I think today I'd have a lot harder time. But I said, you know, it can't be that hard. You know, but you have to be able to see the chutes, and you have to be able to see when the ground is coming up. How can we do that in another way? And so I ended up with a CB radio on my chest. And they would tell me, you have a good chute, but you are indeed heading for a cactus patch.
Breaker, breaker, pull the ripcord.
Exactly. And I thought, well, why can't, you know, and I'm not one of these, I'm going to tie myself to the restaurant door until they make it accessible to my friend in a wheelchair. I'm not that kind of person. That I'm not that militant or that I don't want to make a noise, but I do want to do things everyone else does if there's a way to do it. And by my way of thinking, you just find that way and just be patient and we'll try it. And if I break a leg, I guess it'll be my broken leg, not yours.
And how did you find your way into weaving?
I kept having visions or this image of, I'm also a storyteller and I do an intergenerational story hour with women over 80 and children under 8. And I kept having this vision or this kind of image of weaving a story and how your life is like a tapestry. And I kept thinking, you know, what's warp and what's weft and how do I, you know, if I even want to explain it just to myself, I have to know what that vocabulary means because I keep having this image in my dreams. And so I started reading about weaving and I thought, wait a minute, why read about if you're going to really understand what that means, you need to figure out how to do it. And I had originally thought that I would just get like a small piece of hand weaving and, you know, sort of like a hot pad holder or something like that just to see what it felt like. And before I knew it, I was on a loom with a private teacher, and she was very encouraging. And she makes it a point to make sure that everyone's included in the weaving community. She had just come from teaching a woman that has only one arm, and she thought that was going to be impossible. She said, well, she can weave. Anybody can weave. And so that's how I got interested in it. And then ultimately I ended up with it's a whole other series of very delightful coincidences, but I ended up with a loom and a lot of materials and I'm off and weaving, and all the people in my family are quaking in their boots because they never know what they're going to get for Christmas.
You have to let me interview you again, because you know what? One thing I'd love to do is sit back and have you be a storyteller on Blind Spot. Would that be a possibility at some point?
Do I have to tell the truth?
because
all my stories start off with when we sit around the fire with our second glass of red wine and start our stories, they always begin with almost everything I'll tell you is true. Through our vision and through our the filters of our memory, almost everything I'll tell you is true.
Now, Deborah, how do people get a hold of you if they're interested in just contacting you or possibly ordering one of the books or just kind of saying, wow, you are just one incredible person and I'd like to know you. How can people reach you?
Well, I have an email address, and it is Deborah, well, let me just say it, Deborah@Indra.com, and that's spelled D-E-B-O-R-A-H at Indra, I-N-D-R-A, .com. That's my email address. I also have a website, and that would be the same address, www.indra.com, followed by /expression, and it's singular, expression. I don't mind phone calls. I'm not always here. We're off tap dancing or whatever it is we're doing. And so, but I do have a message machine, of course, and that would be area code 303-823-0530. And I'm always quite frank about what I'm doing at the time. Maybe I'll say I only have 10 minutes or, gee, we have a house full of people. Can I call you back or whatever? So I'll be honest about that.
I really have enjoyed this visit together, and I'm very happy to know that you're my friend, and I'm so glad that I got a request to interview you and that the person that I knew from the Blind Cooks mailing list is the wonderful person that you are, and it's just been a real joy.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt, white sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. Oh, but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth. Yeah, in the daytime I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night I'm a junk food junkie, good Lord have pity on me. Well, at lunchtime you can always find me at the Whole Earth Vitamin Bar, just sucking on my plain white yogurt from a hand-thrown pottery jar. And sipping a little hand-pressed cider with a carrot stick for dessert. And wiping my face in a natural way on the sleeve of my peasant shirt. Oh, yeah. Ah, but when that clock strikes midnight and I'm all by myself, I work at Combination on my secret hideaway shelf. And I pull out some Fritos corn chips, Dr. Pepper, and an old moon pie. Then I sit back in glorious expectation of a genuine junk food high. In the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural. Oh, yeah, in the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. Oh, but at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. All right. My friends down at the commune, they think I'm pretty neat. Oh, I don't know nothing about arts and crafts, but I give them all something to eat. I'm a friend to old Yule Gibbons, and I only eat homegrown spice. I got a John Keats autographed Grecian urn filled up with my brown rice. Yes, I do. Oh, folks, but lately I have been spotted with a Big Mac on my breath. Stumbling into a Colonel Sanders with a face as white as death. I'm afraid someday they'll find me just stretched out on my bed. with a handful of Pringles potato chips and a ding-dong by my head. And in the daytime, I'm Mr. Nasser, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
You've been listening to Blind Spot on ACB Radio. Thanks to our technical people, Chris Bell, for making the music happen, and Jonathan Mosen for making the program possible. If you have any ideas for something you might like to hear on Blind Spot, drop me an email. It's Marlena, MARLAINA, @acbradio.org.